the hell?
Blog Talk Radio.
This is Ann Bauer, and I'm on hold for that talk show.
Hold on, be quiet, please. I got time for you.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is thecrimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. For the next couple of weeks, Denny Griffin is on the road, and we are so happy to be joined, as we will for this entire month, by prosecutor and Women in Crime Inc. contributor Donna Pendergast. Welcome, Donna.
Thanks, Susan. Glad to be here.
And Mr. Vito.
Good evening. Is Denny Griffin with Willie Nelson on the road again?
I think, sir, he is, although, you know, they're probably singing the duet, but I think that they outfitted Denny with an extra set of pigtails, but they were with red hair, not with silver and gray.
I pay money to see that. But welcome, everybody, to the show tonight. We have two interesting segments tonight, and we're going to start off with our first segment. We're going to update the brutal 1990 murders of Cheryl Henry and Andy Atkinson in Houston, Texas. This case was profiled on America's Most Wanted on December 11, 2010. Officers with the Houston Police Department found the bodies of Cheryl Henry, age 22, and Andy Atkinson, age 21, on August 23, 1990, about 100 yards apart in a wooded area that is now a business park in the 1300 block of Enclave Round. Since the murders, investigators have run extensive DNA tests on evidence that was found at the scene and interviewed dozens of possible suspects, but nothing has led to an arrest. Police said that the killer raped Cheryl Henry, leaving behind his DNA. Both victims' throats were slashed. According to the police, the heritage of the individual who left the suspect sample is 100% European, and investigators believe more than one person was involved in the killings. In the year 2000, authorities released a note that surfaced 10 years after the couple was killed. In the note, the writer demanded $100,000 to reveal the killer's identity. Investigators said the note was anonymously mailed to investigators in March of 2001, and no one ever came forward, and the letter writer was never found. Joining us tonight to discuss the current status of the case will be Citizens Against Homicide's victim advocate Gene Cervantes and Garland Atkinson's Andy's father. Welcome, Garland and Gene, to the show tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vito. I believe Andy's mother is also on the line. Are you there, Ann?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the show also.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Now, can I have either Ann or Garland give us a little background on what type of a young man that Andy was? Let's start off by doing that.
He was just a very good kid. He loved sports, and he was so popular in his hometown in North Carolina. And when we had his funeral in Fayetteville, you know, it was just unbelievable the amount of kids his age and friends that he had that came to to you know, the service, and I mean, and it just astounded me. But Andy, as well as Cheryl, I mean, they were 21 and 22 years old. Andy was 2 weeks short of his 22nd birthday. And these two kids said they'd never did anything to anyone to even, you know, deserve something even close to this. He was going to start the University of Houston in September.
Right.
He came down to Houston in June of 90 and went to work out at Gold's Gym, you know, during the summer. And you know, it's just been so frustrating for a crime this violent, a crime this notorious in this city to go 20-plus years unsolved, especially with a matching DNA to another lady that was raped but thankfully not murdered 2 months prior to Andy and Cheryl being killed.
Right.
And, you know, I talked to Gene earlier in the week, and I had called Mike Miller, the lead homicide investigator, today, and I emailed him and was asking, you know, if anything had came from the segment that America's Most Wanted had had, and I didn't get a response.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, Gene Cervantes, these killings that had taken place in Houston were given a name of the Lover's Lane slayings, and they became a pretty high profile, even though this was the age before cable news programs. What is any new developments that you know of, Gene, right now?
You know, Vito, there's a lot of speculation, a lot of rumor, a lot of innuendo, nothing that anybody can hang their hat on as in terms of absolute proof. There's that old saying, you know, I know who did it, but the answer to that is knowing and proving are two different things. In this case, I agree with Garland. There's absolutely no excuse for this many years to pass with no substantial progress.
Right.
It's dumbfounding that nothing has come forward in any of this,
and especially since we have DNA now.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And let me ask you, Ann, your son and Cheryl Henry, they didn't know each other for a long period of time. This was kind of a recent relationship. Am I correct?
Correct. Just since he had moved out there, they had met.
And you met her, I would imagine, right?
No, I have never met her.
Oh, you didn't
meet
her?
I never met her. No, sir.
Okay.
I went to Houston for one of the press conferences, I think in the year 2000, I believe it was, Garland, I can't remember.
Yeah, the 10-year
press
conference, news
conference. And I went, and I met Mr. Henry and Mrs. Henry, you know, and all the family then.
Oh, okay.
I mean, and Cheryl's mother and her family.
Well, let me ask Donna and Susan, from reading the case like I did, what's your first impressions on what you're reading here?
Prosecutor first.
Well, Vito, I got to tell you, knowing what I know about this case, and I'm going to go back and ask Gene in just a minute for the benefit of the listeners who have not heard our prior shows on this case to describe a little bit of the crime scene. But the bottom line is, you know, as a prosecutor and as, you know, having seen many, many brutal homicide scenes, I mean, in this case, you have a couple that, you know, appeared to have been doing what teenagers do, perhaps necking, you know, the seats were down in the car and the key was turned so that the music could play. And then the crime scene shows, you know, some 100 yards away from the car, you have this brutal murder scene. And you have, you know, Cheryl having been raped, the clothes cut off of her body, And, you know, then you have, you know, Andy in a seated position tied to a tree. Well, they were both tied. But I'm saying this is a person, in my experience, the person who committed this, and I know the investigators think that there's multiple persons. I'm not as convinced.
I think there's one person.
I agree with you on that. And I'm going to tell you why in a minute. But this is a person who gets great joy and satisfaction out of doing these things. You know, I prosecuted serial murderer Coral Watts, and I had to look at, you know, some, well, I had to look at hundreds of crime scenes that were very drawn out and, you know, people were tortured and, you know, whatever. But it's just, you know, you get a feeling for it, and you get a feeling, and I get it in this case, that this is something that this guy really liked. He got off on it.
Yeah. And Donna, I agree with you, Donna, simply because also if you go to the history of many of the serial murderers, the vast majority of them by far worked alone, because to get another person involved with you or a third person, they have to be of like mind in the type of murders that they commit, you know? So you have
to
line up.
Well, look at the O.J. case. Look at the O.J. Simpson case on how those both of them were cut up like that. You know,
right.
One's caught. You know, then the other one.
One person can do it.
That's
one
right.
One person can do it. But you know what I find Oh, go on.
Go ahead, Ian.
I'm sorry, but I know that Garland, Andy's father said that Andy was so strong, you know, he would have fought back. I believe that these two kids were terrified out of their minds, and that they were just terrified. They couldn't do anything because they were terrified and they knew they were going to die.
You know what I find is extremely significant is if you look at the facts of the other case, we have a DNA match 17 years later that ties this murder to, as you indicated previously, a rape case where the woman fortunately survived.
Right.
But if you look at the facts of that case, you have a woman who's a dancer at an exotic club. She comes home at 2 in the morning, eats some carryout, and she walks up the stairs in the condo where she lives with her boyfriend, who's a pilot. He's off traveling. And out of the bedroom comes an individual with a fishnet over his face, and he's got a gun, and he says, "Where's Randy?" So clearly he had some knowledge of their relationship. He proceeds to, you know, tie her up, rape her. You know, you've got an individual who, while he was raping her, is extremely, you know, he becomes increasingly vulgar, but, you know, he got off on this. So, you know, this guy gets great satisfaction in what he does, and I do think it's one person.
And look at the note in 2000, released a note that surfaced 10 years after they were killed, and the writer demands $100,000 to reveal the killers, with an S, identities. I find that amazing. It's anonymously
so
a mail to them. And is it to throw people off? Then that shows you right there that somebody knows something, because when you're a writer of a letter like that, you take a lot of chances.
In the other rape case, it was like the murder case. I mean, she was bound. You know, you've just got similarities that show you that this is a person who likes this. He gets off on it. And, you know, he even tried to throw her off track, suggesting, "You didn't notice, you know, I'm in a military uniform." And, you know, later what she described could have been some sort of a uniform, but it sounded more like a security guard uniform.
But, Donna, DNA doesn't lie. DNA doesn't lie.
No, that's what I'm saying. Exactly, Susan. DNA doesn't lie. You absolutely have the same person that committed these two crimes, and the fact that he's binding up his victims and you know, raping women in both circumstances, this is a serial rapist / murderer.
Yeah, see, and with this new evidence that have come out for the first time, the investigators on this case are considering the possibility that the man who attacked them either frequented or worked at the local strip clubs because of this other lady's rape. So at least we can take some solace in some progress being made now, many, many years after the crime is committed because of DNA. Garland, what else can you tell us about what's new? Do you have communication with the police department on a regular basis now?
No.
No? No.
I get emails infrequently from Mike Miller if something would happen to come up.
So now Mike Miller has
taken...
As I
said, I have been in no contact at all and received no response from my email, but Mike Miller, he may have been out of the office. I have his email address, and usually if I email him, I'll get an answer right back, but I have heard not one word from HPD or anyone for that matter since the show aired on America's Most Wanted the 11th of last month.
So the homicide detective, Billy Beck, just retired about a year ago. So this Mike Miller is the new fellow that is working on it?
He is correct. He is the lead investigator now, and I had talked to Billy. Billy got his law degree while he was in homicide, and he works with an attorney here in Houston now. And I spoke with him 2 weeks ago and had forwarded him some material that I had to let him look over it. And I gave him all of my contact numbers, my email and everything, and I believe he had also talked to Denny.
Yeah, he talked to Denny, and I talked with Denny about the conversation, and Billy had nothing of any significance to offer. He says that there have been no leads. Denny, I believe, had made some comment about, rumors that there was some additional DNA, and he discounted that. He says no, there's a lot of inconsistencies in the information that's passed back and forth that indicate that the Houston Police Department is in possession of some additional forensics. We're not privy to know. And I wouldn't expect to know because we've jeopardized the integrity of the investigation. But
exactly.
But we, there are a lot of questions that I still have about the investigation. But you know, we just guess. It's a guessing game. We have our suspicions. It could have been one guy. It could have been two.
But, Gene, so doesn't somebody know something? I mean, I keep looking at this thing. I'm sure there was more to this letter that was sent to investigators.
Oh, absolutely.
The only thing that I thought about that letter, Billy Belt came and visited me in 2000, about a month before they had the 10-year press conference in 2000, for me to sign a contract with Crime Stoppers to put up a $50,000 cash reward. Now, that was in place during that time. Whether or not the people that wrote that letter knew something, but as I said, it seemed just like, was said earlier, for someone to put themselves out there on that really precarious limb to get involved and write a letter like that and give Houston Homicide how to contact them through the classified, et cetera, it would seem that, you know, maybe they were trying to get money, but at the same time, I also believe that someone out there knows that, very possibly the person that wrote that letter.
Right.
But, it could be somebody that he's married to, in a relationship with, has a child with. It could be somebody in that area that is missing, is in an intimate partner homicide case because they know too much.
Somebody that's divorced from a subject now.
That's right.
Things that I
don't know. I think it's not divorced. I think it's dead. I think it's somebody out that way that somebody should start, if they can, start combing through some of the cases of the missing right in that area of women who were married, who, you know, maybe somebody who had an order of protection.
Well, you know,
approximately two weeks after the Henry Atkinson murder, a young lady by the name of Stephanie Buehler went missing, and she's
19 years old on the 8th of September.
Yeah, continues to be on missing status.
So she was never found. She was never found then.
Right. Exactly.
But if she knew something, then he would have done away with her. But I'm also looking at
another victim, a random victim.
Gene, why don't you tell? Gene, why don't you tell our listeners how many people were involved in these Lubber Lane incidents? How many people have either been murdered or disappeared? What kind of a total do we have here?
Well,
and
what
over
I know,
how many years? And over how many years? If
yeah, what
knows.
I know since the Henry case, one prior to that was the victim, the rape victim, not homicide. That's the only one I know of. And in addition to the Henry Atkinson case, the Bueller, 19-year-old Stephanie Bueller went missing.
In that same area
as well. And she went missing from the exact area of the very, very close proximity to the enclave area.
About 3 miles.
Yeah. So all of it is in that same or those three are right in the same general vicinity.
Okay.
So that's about all I know. I know that, through rumor, that phone calls have been made to Houston Police Department. Nothing is being shared. But to me, this case is solvable.
Right.
And
especially now.
Especially now. And with the information that the authorities have, and I believe that they need to have an extensive concentration in the investigation. But
let me ask top prosecutor Donna Pendergast. Donna, do you know if Texas has a DNA system like many of the states? I know Connecticut does, where they every couple weeks, every month, every 2 months, continue to check the DNA of new prisoners coming in and out of the jails. Do you know if they do that or not there?
Vito, no, I do not know the answer to that
question. Because we talked about it a few weeks ago. We know that some states do and some states don't.
Right.
And it's kind of not put together altogether right now.
But what I do know about Texas, unfortunately, is they have the same problem that we have here in Michigan and that many, many states have around the nation. It's even been profiled on Law and Order. And that is that they have a backlog of rape kits that there is just not sufficient resources to test them all. And in fact, in this case, the way that they came up with the connection between this woman who was raped 2 months before this murder and the murder was in 2007, finally, Texas, Harris County, which I'm very familiar with from the Coral Watts case, but
right.
They started submitting, backlogs of these old rape cases, and all of a sudden they got a hit. And we have that very same problem here in Michigan. In Michigan, and I'm not sure the number here, but I believe it's close to 10,000 backlogged rape kits that are sitting places like, in the Detroit Police Department, the Pontiac Police Department, some of our larger cities, and, there's just not resources to test them. Everybody tries for grants and et cetera to get money to start testing some of these things, but, you do, and look what happens in this case. It's like, wait a minute, this murder, this horrific, brutal murder is connected to a rape of a woman a mere 2 months before.
That's a good point, Donna. Go ahead, sir.
Donna, the problem that they had here in Houston as far as their crime lab, it was in total shambles for several
Same
years.
Michigan and Detroit.
They were having to farm out the DNA to a company in the Dallas-Fort Worth area to get the DNA tested because they didn't have the facilities in place through HPD here in Houston to even do their own testing, and didn't get their laboratory back up and running until, I guess, the last maybe couple of years. So I can imagine the backlog they have here.
My frustration with this whole investigation is that, and I've said this before, law enforcement has an obligation and responsibility to protect and serve. And to me, that means put in as much as you have to solve a murder. The best way to prevent reduce the murder rate is to solve murders, because a lot of these murderers are repeat offenders. They get away with it. Oh, now they're empowered. They feel, okay, I'm untouchable. But the point I'm trying to make is you, as an investigator, should be going out seeking the funds, whatever it takes, to get these cases solved. California isn't any different from Michigan and Texas. We have our,
I mean,
our backlog.
A lot of times it's money. You need money to do things.
Yeah. And
it's also the databases talking to each other. That doesn't happen. And like you said, those rape kits sit on the shelves. They don't pay attention. You know, they can't get to them. I think
there could be
more
there. There could be more there with the same DNA.
Yeah.
You know what? I have to chime in here, though, just because I've been doing this for 24 years, and I understand the frustration that's being expressed from all sides. That all being said, I'm a fan of law enforcement, and even from my brief time being a prosecutor in Detroit, 2.5 years, I mean, these guys are working on a homicide, and, you know, 10 hours later, they've got 4 more homicides, and they're off to those homicides, and it's great to say they should do whatever they need to do. But
I don't think it's about them,
Donna.
It's not about them. It's about what's not available for them to use as far as funding. It's not. It never has anything to do with them. And we're all pro-law enforcement. It's not that. It's just give them the tools then instead of, you know, so that they can follow through with the cases, because you can't go in one armed and do these investigations. It doesn't help.
Yeah, and throughout my participation on these shows, I've always, and so has Vito, and so has Danny, and so have you, Susan, that we've always advocated that we're not indicting the entire law enforcement community. It's just certain cases that need to be addressed for whatever reason.
Or in this case, Donna, could the FBI, because of the history, because of the connection, is this make an FBI type of an investigation?
You know,
for this type of
thing? No, not really. I mean, in my experience, the FBI gets involved when it crosses state lines, or
it's not even going to speed up. That wouldn't speed it up at all, because they're the sorry thing we have here is, like Donna talked about before, the DNA is stacked up in police departments. The problem with that, as you take care of every 2 DNAs, another 10 come in. You're looking at Detroit, which is, if not number one, it's in the top 3 of the worst crimes in the country, and you have Houston, that's probably in the top 10 last time I looked. So you got crimes that are happening quicker than the cases are being not only solved but even looked at, and that's the whole sorry situation that we deal with here. And maybe, hopefully, and I'm hoping that both Ann and Garland at least have some new, a little bit of optimism now over the events of the last year. Can either one of you answer that, please?
Well, I wanted to ask Gene if he knew of anything that came out of the America's Most Wanted thing. Has he
nothing.
Nothing.
I've heard nothing. Absolutely nothing.
No.
Well,
you know,
that was
the one thing. I didn't personally, you know, I wasn't fond of the way they portrayed that incident.
No.
You know, but the one thing that was important to me, and you know, I would go along with anything, is at least we got it nationwide, coast to coast. That's the most
important
for me.
Yeah, public exposure is very important. And in, relative to what you said, Susan, about the FBI, I've talked to FBI agents, and they've and FBI supervising agents, and they say unless we're invited in, or there's some indication that there was a serial killer involved or crossing state lines, we're not going to get involved. So other agencies, however, are available, and I'm exploring those possibilities as a possible alternative to the Houston Police Department.
Well, good for you, Gene.
The Houston Police Department has an obligation to ask for help. There's nothing wrong with asking for help. You know, but
no,
I
agree. I certainly agree.
So,
you know,
Go ahead, Donna.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, the one thing I can inject here, and I can tell you, is personally as a prosecutor, I've had 4 cases that are at least 30 years old. You know, they all, you know, have ranged from that same year, 78, 79. I'm actually looking at a case right now that's considerably older than that. So there's always hope. There's always hope that that final piece of the puzzle will fall into place.
And we are running out of time.
Our motto at Citizens Against Homicide is never give up on finding the truth.
That's right.
Yeah,
and
that's
we
right.
are out of time, Garland and Ann. And where can people leave a tip or how much is the reward up to now for the case?
You know, I don't know. I don't even want to get in my deal with Crime Stoppers, but I left that $50,000 in place for a year. And nothing came. That letter came, I guess, right along the time that the $50,000 pulled up. The amount of reward now, I know Crime Stoppers generally puts $5,000 of their money up, and there was an additional $10,000 from one of the places where Cheryl used to bartend, Sam's Boat. Whether or not that is in place, I really don't know.
Gene, where can people then leave information if they do know something? Because I always say there's somebody listening that knows something. They always seem to come on the show, and they're in as a guest right now. What's the website?
And what they can do is they could email or Citizens Against Homicide or my personal email. CAH@theadvocate@yahoo.com.
All right. Thank you, Ann, and thank you, Garland, and we'll have you back on as hopefully we get some updates.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And, Gene, I'll be talking to you.
Thank you, Garland. Thank you, Ann.
All right.
Thank you. All
right.
Bye.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you, Garland, and we'll have you back.
Detective Villaraza?
Hello?
Yeah, Detective Villaraza, Broward County Sheriff's Office.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. This is our second case, Vito.
All right.
Okay, that's yours, Donna.
Yeah, all right. Moving right along, I'm going to introduce our second case, our second segment for the night.
Hello.
We'll be with you in just a second.
Okay.
Olga Perlante, 71 years old, was an elderly widow who lived alone at 4200 Southwest 53rd Court in Dania Beach, Florida. On March 13, 1997, Mrs. Perlante was savagely assaulted, strangled, and her home was ransacked during an apparent robbery. The investigation by the Broward County Sheriff's Department, homicide unit in Florida, is ongoing, and detectives remain committed to finding the killer and bringing him to justice. Joining us tonight, Gene Cervantes is still with us from Citizens Against Homicide. And Olga's eldest son, Fred Perlante, and Detective Frank Lazara of the Broward County Sheriff's Department to discuss the case. Let me ask you, Fred, I'm hoping you're on with us tonight.
Yes, I am.
Can you tell
You know what you need to do, please? Turn down your radio or turn down the computer, please, because your echo's coming back.
Okay.
Who are you talking to, Susan?
Someone has their computer on, somebody that just came on.
Yeah, somebody has it very loud in the background.
Yeah, me. Am I okay?
Okay. All right, Fred, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your mother and, you know, just a little bit about what she was all about, and then we'll talk about what happened to her.
Well, my mother was a very pleasant woman. She was very well loved by everyone. She had many friends. Everybody that met her was always very close to her. While she was in Florida, she had friends walking by, giving her donuts, and stopping by the house to say hello. All her neighbors would always wave by, stop by and talk for a while to her. She was never, you know, out of place with anybody. Everybody seemed to love her.
And she was 71 years old, am I correct?
Correct.
The mother of nine children.
Right, she had several grandchildren. Her favorite time of the year was Easter to dress up all the kids, and also for Christmas time to buy all the presents for the kids or all her grandchildren and everything else. It was just like she was Santa Claus herself. That was her greatest two holidays.
All right. Detective Frank Loza, am I pronouncing that correctly, of the Broward County Sheriff's Department. Can you tell us a little bit about what we know or what is known about the facts of the murder and how she was found?
Sure. It's Ilo Raza, first of all. You can call me Frank.
How's that?
That's very good. No problem. Yes. Yes, I know. Miss Parlante, she was also partially paralyzed on one side. She lived alone. And this was like a 25-apartment complex, two-story apartment complex. It's a working-class type of residence. Her granddaughter was the one who found her in the morning. We know that she was heard of alive at about 10 o'clock when she was supposed to go play bingo Wednesday night. She never made it to bingo, which was her usual. She usually would take a cab or have a friend drive her. We know that her friend wasn't going to take her, so she would have taken a cab, but she never called for a cab. So we knew she was alive at about 10 o'clock. And the next morning she's found about 8:30 in the morning by her granddaughter. She had a habit of leaving her door unlocked, so there was no forced entry. The house was ransacked, very disorganized ransacking. It's indicative of a typical burglar, looking for anything of value, someone possibly with a drug habit, to support. Maybe somebody that knew her habits, because it looks like she was the only one targeted. There was no other, burglaries in the complex that night, no other attempts. So it might have been someone that knew that either she was going to go to bingo or, just looking for something of value.
What kind of area is this? Was she near the airport? Was she near a community that was near the beach?
No, it's someone that had to know that area. The main streets are in there. This is like an apartment complex in the back. It's a residential. It's off of the main streets of the main strip. So it's out of the way. So it's like somebody that just driving by wouldn't have, just not seen it. So it would have been somebody that's familiar with the area.
And Detective Frank, have you been on this case since 97 or more recently?
97. I'm the original lead detective on it. We've had other detectives, working it with me since then. We sent it up to the FBI. They profiled it, and they kind of came up to the same conclusions that we had. As far as evidence, we have very little evidence. No eyewitnesses. No one heard anything unusual. So at that point in the investigation.
Now, the two, what is written in the report I'm reading, at least, two people that could be prime suspects, are you still able to clock their whereabouts now? You still know where each one of them are? The burglar with the criminal history, and the other was the relative who was dealing drugs. You still know the whereabouts of both of them?
We know there were a couple of people of persons of interest. We don't have any concrete evidence pointing to them. It's just they've been persons of interest, and we've been keeping we keep tabs on them, know where they are, and if they get arrested, obviously we look into it and everything else. But it's a case that it should be solved. It's not something that was planned or anything like that. You figure it's a typical burglar. The family offered quite a large amount of money. We had flyers posted everywhere. They had a candlelight vigil every year for quite a few years after it happened on the anniversary of this. And we make sure that it got a lot of media coverage. So you figure if it was your typical burglar, they would have been talking about it. The things that were taken, a television set, minor things that you think they'd probably turn over for cash, for drugs or whatever. So somebody, they would have told somebody. So you figure if it's a typical burglar, they would have talked to somebody about it. And with that kind of money that was being offered, I think the family was offering up to $25,000 at one time. Somebody would have came forward and given it.
I had $50,000 cash that one time, if you remember, Frank, won the call.
Yep. Oh, yeah, we had the posters out there, because I remember, we went out there and we put them all over. We even had it in the paper. So,
go ahead, Donna.
Detective Frank, let me ask you this. You've indicated that, you've got a 71-year-old woman, and she was last talked to at 10 p.m., and then she was supposed to go to bingo. I mean, I'm sure our listeners are saying, like, wait a minute, what? Can you explain for our listeners what you know of the time frame and what her routine was expected to be that
sure.
night? And what I should say, what was routine for her? Because
yeah, for,
you know, that sounds
her,
a little bit unusual, but I know that
well,
she had a routine
yeah.
that was a little
correct,
unusual.
Correct. For her, the routine would be she loved to go to the night owls. That was nighttime bingo. It was like around 11 o'clock. And like her friend would usually drive her or she would take a cab. And they knew her at the bingo hall. And we checked with them, and they said, no, she never arrived. They have video there. We checked the video, so we know that she never arrived. We checked with the local cab companies that she usually would take. They never got a call from her. So she was probably surprised right after she got that phone call from her friend at 10 o'clock because she told her friend that she was ready to go. So she probably would have, right after her friend, the next thing she would have done was probably call for a cab. She never did. So we figured this happened right around 10 o'clock at night.
How
okay.
about any DNA at the scene, sir? Any DNA?
We do. We have some. We have two profiles, but they're not enough to put into the database.
Okay.
They're enough for comparison or to build up on it, but they're not enough to enter into the national database. So we're kind of – and those patterns, the profiles that we have, we can't say for sure that they are the suspects. It's not one of those. And we do have some latents. It's the same thing with the latents. We can't say for sure that these are the latents of the suspect, but they're unidentified at this point in time.
And just so our listeners understand, when you say latents, you're referring to fingerprints?
Correct, fingerprints that were lifted. You know, there were several of them, and some of them were kind of interest because they were near the area where she was. But then again, you know, it could be answered as if we identify them, but we do have to identify them to find out who this person is, and if you know the reason why this person was there, it could be a reason for it. But we can't say that these belong to the suspect, so we're kind of at a standstill at that point. And again, we haven't been able to identify them.
Any other crimes around that time that happened similar to this one?
Well, we checked with the local, with burglaries are burglaries, and wherever you go. So we checked with and it's usually locals, and we even had confidential informants out there working, for us, and they didn't hear anything. And we checked on all the local burglars that got arrested around that time and who have had been arrested, in the past, and nothing came out of it.
I was just gonna ask the detective, being an ex-cop myself, and I always say, and it's common knowledge with police officers, it seems like in a person's career as a cop or a private detective or what may a prosecutor it could be, you always get that one or two cases that stick in the pit of your stomach that you feel could have gone a better way. Is this one of them for you? Is this one that you really like to nail?
Oh, definitely. Again, this is, we're looking at a true victim here. She did nothing to cause this.
The brutality of the crime, too.
The brutality. I think that she was surprised. Whoever went in there maybe didn't expect her to be there. That's why we were concentrating on people that knew her, routine. Because, maybe she was surprised, and that's why they did it. And, they were forced to. I guess, she knew who it was. And, maybe they, decided that they'd rather just, kill her so she couldn't identify them. And then they just ran, and I say they, we don't know if it's one or two. There's something.
To, it was more than one because of the way she was beaten. I mean, she even tried to get out of the doorway and had blood all on the outside of the doorway, if you remember right. So some
of
that.
There's certain things that there are certain things that we don't want to put out there because then when we do get information back, we want to know how credible it is or not. But there's a possibility that it might have been more than one person in there. We can safely say that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if this seems to be a steady time that she goes to bingo on a certain day, it doesn't take a lot for neighbors or relatives or friends to kind of know this individual does the same thing at the same time on the same night,
Correct.
What about the building maintenance man?
No, we checked them. We did complete backgrounds on them and everything else. There were several maintenance workers that we looked into, and nothing came out of that either.
Detective Frank, let me ask you this. any evidence of sexual assault whatsoever?
No, that I could safely say that. No, that there wasn't. This was just that. This was definitely a burglary that went bad. And like I said, she really didn't have much to offer.
What did they take?
A television set, a 20-inch television set. There was an AM and FM radio clock that was missing. We're not sure on that. The family thinks that she had it there and it was not there. Mantle clock and whatever small amount of cash she had in her purse. I mean, she really didn't have much. I mean, she lived within her means. More or less the same type of people that lived in the complex. They're all working, hardworking people that live in that apartment complex. And so, it's not luxury homes. It's not a luxury neighborhood. So when you go to do a burglary, that you're not expecting to find, luxury items. You just get whatever they can get out of it.
So a 71-year-old woman is brutally murdered for a mantle clock, a small amount of cash, and a small color TV. God, what a
20,
tragedy.
A 20-inch TV set. And we had the serial number because the family was able to get me the serial number on it. So we've checked pawn shops and, trying to find it. We've entered it into our teletype system. So if whatever's run, it'll come back. And it never showed up. And you figure if it was somebody there, and we made that clear in the paper that it was taken. So you think if somebody would have bought a 20-inch television set from local thief or whatever, for that reward money, they would say, "Look, I bought a television set from this guy here, just to try and get the reward money." But nothing ever came out of it. So apparently, either they realized once they took it that it might get traced back or whatever, and they just disposed of it, but it has never surfaced.
Detective Frank, let me ask you this, just so our jurors, you can tell I'm a prosecutor, so our listeners understand, I just said the words, a brutal murder was committed. Can you tell our listeners how Ms. Parlante was found? I mean, exactly what happened to her in this brutal robbery/murder?
Well, it's common knowledge. It was out in the media that she was strangled. It looks like she did try to make it to the door, and they dragged her back in, and she was just found laying on the floor in the middle of her dining area there. It's a small apartment. It's a two-bedroom apartment. So as soon as her granddaughter opened the door, which was unlocked at the time when she went that morning, she opened the door and she just saw her laying there on the floor. She was already dead.
I believe they tried to, correct me if I'm wrong, Detective Villaraza, but she also was gagged to prevent her from screaming.
The family kind of put that out there, was, they put something over her mouth to keep her from screaming. But she was known to have a loud mouth, basically. She was a very boisterous lady.
Okay.
Do you think this was a burglary stage to cover the homicide?
No, it really wasn't about
a burglary?
No, definitely not. I mean, well, first of all, couldn't find any reason why you would want to kill a 71-year-old lady, no matter what. And then that's one of the first things you look at is whether it's a staged scene or not. And this was overkill. I mean, whoever went in there, they were they looked like they were just desperate, looking for whatever they can get.
Yeah.
They, tore drawers apart, empty them out, empty her contents of her purse all over the place. So they were definitely, trying to find anything of value that they can get their hands on.
Yeah. And Susan,
burglary gone bad.
What? I'm sorry, what?
No, that's burglary gone bad, basically.
Susan, it sounds to me by somebody that worked narcotics for a long time, somebody desperately in need of a hit and, take a 20-inch television or whatever just to get enough for a couple of bags for that night. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. I don't have any evidence on it, but just from my background and training.
Vito, I think what you're saying is, and our listeners may not understand this term, but it was really a very disorganized killing. And can you explain for listeners what that term really means in terms of an investigator, and when you come on a crime scene, when you see an organized killing versus a disorganized killing?
Yeah, well, I mean, just look at the items that were taken, and, I mean, you know, it could have been staged, of course. I doubt it, okay? This kind of has the earmarks to me, though, of somebody that, you know, is targeting an elderly woman. They could be on some kind of drugs, be it coke or heroin, PCP, whatever it may be, and they need to get something. They know, a lot of times, if they do know the individual, the woman, if they know who she is, they're probably figuring they're not going to get a lot of money in there. You know, this is not a wealthy residence they're breaking into. But all they need is $20, $30, $40, $50 to get them through the next day or so. So, I mean, that's what it appears to be for me. It may not be, but that kind of has that kind of screams that out to me.
Detective,
so
talk to... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so in other words, you know, as opposed to, you know, what we saw in our last segment where, you know, at least in terms of the woman who was raped before the actual murder of, you know, Henry and Atkinson occurred, you know, the rape case, he knew the woman's name, he was in there. I mean, that was what I would call an organized killing. I mean, in this case, if I understand you, Vito, what you're saying is, you know, basically you have a case where there's, you know, no planning, you know, just really a crime scene that shows that somebody just came in and ransacked the place.
Yeah, I mean, like
it's
said in the report.
It's not a really organized crime scene.
Yeah, and the reports that we had gotten to read, you know, it says here it was committed by someone without great skill and with a clear lack of control. So I'm sure the detective would say, you know, since he's been the one on it for all these years, that it kind of probably impressed him that, too, when he showed up at the scene, especially after finding out what's taken.
Let's hear from you.
No, I agree with you. I mean, it was disorganized, the ransacking, and it's like I had the gut feeling that it was somebody that knew her, just targeted her, and thought that she might be out at that time, either playing bingo or whatever, and goes in there and gets surprised by her. She surprises him and maybe recognizes him, and he just, you know, does what he has to do to keep her quiet. And then afterwards, you know, he just starts ransacking everything, trying to get as much as whatever he can out of there, knowing that she is now dead, laying there, and he obviously is alone. There's nobody else going to be coming. So he has this time. He just ransacks the apartment and takes whatever he can.
And Donna, as you know, as a prosecutor, myself as a cop, and of course the good detective we have on the show here tonight, is that when somebody needs those drugs, it doesn't matter if they kill their grandmother or the lady up the street, and it sounds like a senseless killing, but what goes through their mind and the urge, be it heroin or cocaine or whatever it is that they're on, they don't care whatever they have to do, and they don't want to leave the subject there to be able to ID them. And, you know, and our listeners need to understand that, because many people would say, I can't believe somebody got killed for a couple of dollars in a 20-inch TV. For that drug addict, it doesn't really even matter. It's enough to get them through the night, so to speak.
Right. You know, Vito,
yeah,
before we run out of time, I'd like to just comment, you know, like I said during the last segment, we don't indict the entire law enforcement community. And what Detective Villarraza has done and the support he's given and the attention he's given this investigation is to be, he's to be complimented for. He's supportive of the reward, supportive of the posters, supportive of the press conferences. He's on the show for a specific reason, and I applaud him for that.
I give him, as an ex-cop,
yeah,
I give him
really
kudos. I give him kudos for staying on the case and being loyal to the case and to keep digging and digging.
Yeah.
And a lot of times,
and that's what we need. And he even went as far as to get the FBI involved, and that's what I mean meant in the last segment, reaching out, asking for help, because we don't always have the ability to solve a particular crime by ourselves.
Well, I also would like to come to thank the son, I mean, Fred Polanta. He's the one that's been really, I mean, he's written to the governor, he's written to senators. He's been on this from the beginning, from day one. He sacrificed a lot out of his life, and you know, it's the way, you know, it should be.
Yeah. Well.
Thank you, Frank.
Yeah.
Well, it's his mom.
Yeah, and we at Citizens Against Homicide will be featuring his mother's profile, I believe, in another month or two. I don't have my notes with me relative to that, but we'll be profiling her in our monthly newsletter that gets national distribution, and it'll be mailed to all concerned persons in the Port Lauderdale area, and Detective Bill Araza will also get a copy.
And also, Broward Sheriff's Office continues to keep the case up on their site as well.
Yeah.
Yes, and you know, anyone with information can call our Crime Stoppers line, which is 954-497-TIPS, or even my office, 321-4210, same area code, and you know, remain anonymous. And you know, there's got to be somebody out there that knows something. I mean, and I think it's somebody that knew her, and you know, so there's got to be somebody out there that knows something.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Susan and Vito and I have all seen these types of cases time and time over again. Somebody always knows something.
Exactly.
That's right. And community is enough. I mean, I happen to be familiar with the area. And that area is a nice area. And
oh, yeah.
You would think, you know, that people, and because of her bingo community, because of just the activity that goes around in that area, you would think that people
in
would,
that area,
somebody would come forward.
Yep.
There's somebody there that knows who did it without a single doubt in my mind.
That's right. Yep.
And you know, we just hope that they have the intestinal fortitude and the, you know, to come forward.
No, we'll keep trying. Believe me, this is not going to be you know, put away in your shelf somewhere. This is going to. I'll be around for quite a few more years.
Good, and I have no doubt. I have no doubt that you're going to work hard.
And Gene, where can people submit cases to you on unsolved cases? How can they do that?
They can call. Well, the best way is to go on to email us at cahtheadvocate@yahoo.com.
And then also. You'll be featuring this case. We are running out of time. Thank you, Detective. And,
you
know, keep us posted, please. Next week, everybody, we're featuring the case of Molly Beach for the entire hour. Her case is going to be featured on Investigation Discovery Channel on Monday, January 17th at 9 p.m. Eastern. And then we're going to chronicle the show here next Tuesday on the 18th for an entire hour. So please come back with us. That's going to be very interesting. Thank you to the Crime Wire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton and Public Relations team at Imagine Publicity. Our next show will be Tuesday, January 18th, 2010. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Or hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, please go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play.
Susan, I want to talk about a little case for 1 minute before I close, okay, since we have a minute or two
here.
Yes,
sir.
Okay, on my show this coming Sunday night, Crime Time with Vito Colucci, PI, and the Business Talk Radio and Lifestyle Talk Radio Network, it's probably the most amazing case that I have seen. It's a woman by the name of Liz Sicuro. It was a nationwide case, 1984. She was viciously raped as a freshman at the University of Virginia. They did nothing for her. The university campus police did nothing. The Charlottesville police did nothing. Fast forward at 20-something years from then, she gets married, has a couple children. She receives a letter in the mail from the perpetrator, who is now an AA. And I guess one of the steps he had to do was go back or apologize or make amends with people that he's hurt in the past. And I'm telling you, the story is so powerful. Her book just came out this week called Crash Into Me that we're doing 2 weeks on it. She gets him arrested. He finally gets arrested. He's convicted. And then it even gets more bizarre after that. So if anybody wants to hear an absolutely amazing case, please tune in for that one. And it's so big that we're doing 2 weeks on it. But the first week is this week. But anyway, remember that we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Donna Pendergast, and Susan Murphy Milano. And we thank Gene Cervantes especially for being on tonight. Thank you and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Gene.
Okay, thank you, Fred.